Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple. Work from home is a real thing, but does it matter where home is? Bali, Auckland, Paris? What does it take to become a digital nomad? Now, before you make the lifestyle change, there are some financial aspects you'll probably want to consider. Nora Dunn is a digital nomad. She's also a personal finance expert. She's going to talk us through the ins and outs. And if you've been to the grocery store recently, you have most definitely noticed the higher prices. But not everyone is spending more for food these days. At least not Claire Tansey. She's here to share some money-saving tips. The transition to retirement is not always easy, and there can be more to navigate if you're in a relationship. If you and your partner are not on the same page, it can cause a lot of strain. Amy Dupree is Chief Executive of Life Transitions. She'll be here to talk about how to make this transition smooth sailing for the both of you. If you own a small business, it can be very difficult to secure funding. EQO is a company that is building a matchmaking platform to connect entrepreneurs and investors. CEO Barry Hillier is here to talk about it. Plus, we'll hear about Clear Estate, which is an online platform that provides estate planning, but also settlement services in one place. This is Moolah La, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and by Home Equity Bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Let's get started. The way that we work has changed. It has changed and it continues to change. Some people are heading back to the office 5 days a week. Some are only working from home. Others are taking their work abroad. And I get so excited just thinking about this idea. If you are looking to make the shift to becoming a digital nomad, there's obviously huge opportunities, but there are also some financial considerations that you need to think about. Nora Dunn is a longtime digital nomad, like long, long time before the pandemic. She's also a financial expert at NerdWallet, and she's going to talk about some of the financial ins and outs of this particular lifestyle choice. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Where is the most glamorous place you have ever worked?
Oh, must I
know it's
choose?
A hard call because I know you're making you choose. I mean, you've been doing this since what, 2006?
I have. I'm considered an OG.
Give me one example. It doesn't have to be the most, but a glamorous place.
Well, I'll tell you a pretty sweet gig that I had. I was house sitting for 3 months in Switzerland one summer. And among other things, I had not only the three-story house in Zurich, but I also had a Swiss Alpine cottage. I had the car. I could be at either place whenever I wanted. All I had to do was open the mail and keep the orchids alive. So that was pretty glamorous. And it was completely free as well. So there's that.
How do you define the phrase digital nomad? What does it mean to you?
Digital nomad, it's interesting, is in its initial incantations, the pure definition of digital nomad was someone who works remotely while traveling full-time and not having a home base at all. Now, a common misconception about what it means to be a digital nomad is that it is a job, as in, how do I apply to be a digital nomad? But the reality is, it's a lifestyle, it's not a job. So it's a lifestyle that's enabled by the ability to work remotely. And you can work remotely as an employee of a company or as a freelancer or an online business owner. And certainly if we look at silver linings from the pandemic, it is that companies around the world were forced to go remote or become obsolete. So now there are millions upon millions of people who have remote careers. And now if they choose, they have the ability to start traveling long-term while working remotely. So that initial pure definition of digital nomad being someone who is completely homeless and travels full time has actually broadened now. And it is now includes anyone who likes to travel long term while working remotely, even if you have a home base, we'll still call you a digital nomad.
We're going to talk about the financials in a second. But before we do, what would you say is the single best part about being a digital nomad for you? What has that be awesome?
My immediate answer and the immediate answer of pretty much anyone who does this, has this as a lifestyle, will be one word: freedom. It is the freedom to work where you want, when you want, how you want. And really to be able to choose your vista. So again, it's important to note that a digital nomad lifestyle is not a vacation per se. You are working full time. But the advantage is when you close your laptop for the day and the day's work is done, you have a completely new destination on your doorstep to explore and to really experience what it's like to live around the world in these different amazing spots.
I love that you started with the image of you in Zurich and the chalet and all that. I can imagine one of the things for digital nomads to figure out is the cost component. Where are they living? How much does it cost? Not everybody is going to be able to go from house sit to house sit. What advice do you have on managing the accommodation line of the budget?
Accommodation is going to be your single most expensive component of the digital nomad lifestyle. I actually stumbled in my own journey to becoming a digital nomad. I stumbled into all these ways to actually get accommodation for free. And house sitting is just one of five different ways that you can actually get your accommodation for free while traveling the world. And in my first 10 years abroad, I saved over $100,000 by getting my accommodation for free. And before you conjure up some image of me staying in, you know, a cardboard shack at the side of the road or having to, you know, bunk up in dorms and share showers, I was staying in places like this Swiss Alpine cottage that I mentioned. So that's definitely, if you can save the money on accommodation by getting it for free, that's going to be fantastic. But that's not going to be everybody's speed, and not all of the five forms of free accommodation are perfectly suited to the digital nomad lifestyle. Here's the thing. When you get out of the vacation mindset and you start traveling slowly around the world, you will not be staying in hotels. So your cost of accommodation might not be as high as you might think at the outset if you were planning a 1 or 2 week vacation somewhere, because you will have the ability to rent places on longer term bases, so that will cost you less. You can also look at various new things that are coming up for digital nomads, like co-living opportunities where you have your own room and bathroom, but then you might share common area spaces and workspaces. So there are lots of new things that are coming around that can help you not only save money on common accommodation, but then also to have some really interesting cultural experiences. One thing that I was really pleased to discover, and it completely surprised me when I started traveling full time, is that the cost to travel full time is actually much lower than it is to live in one place. And saving money on accommodation was one of those reasons, but then there were a few other reasons, like currency and geo arbitrage. And also too, quite frankly, when everything you own fits into a suitcase, you're not going to buy a lot of stuff. So right. Consumerism is taken right off the table.
How do you think about banking? Because, you know, you can bank online anywhere, but in many cultures, you still need to have cash in your wallet in order to buy stuff at the market.
Absolutely. While as a world, we're definitely moving more towards the plastic society and not using cash, there are some countries where cash is still king. And there's a few pieces of advice that I have, one of which is make sure you have a travel-friendly bank account. So when you use foreign ATMs, if you have a really basic no-frills type of bank account, you're likely to get charged every time you use the ATM. Now, when I was in Peru and I had to pay for my accommodation with cash, the ATMs in Peru also had a really low withdrawal limit. So within one session at the ATM, I had to make multiple withdrawals. And I realized at the end of the day, I just paid like $30 in withdrawal fees because of that. So if you have a travel-friendly bank account, look for a bank account that includes free foreign ATM withdrawals. Now, this usually is something that's included in a higher tier, a higher level of bank account. So it might come with a monthly fee. However, if you maintain a certain balance in that account, then you won't have to pay that monthly fee. The other really big piece of advice I have is if you have the opportunity to use a credit card, make sure you have a credit card with no foreign transaction fees. That is also expressed as no FX fees. This is going to save you an invisible 3% surcharge that the credit card company would otherwise tack onto the base currency exchange rate. You don't see it, but it is the silent killer of budgets. And using credit cards while you travel is really fantastic for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is being able to track your expenses. You could often get frequent flyer miles or cash back. So it's great to use a card, but you just got to make sure you're using the right one. have to say, at nerdwallet.ca, if you click on the credit card section at the top of the page, you'll find all kinds of really interesting guides that'll help you find the perfect credit card for your specific needs.
How do you think about taxes? Where do you pay? How do you make sure you save enough? Because maybe it's not withdrawn at source if you're a freelancer.
Yeah, depending on your employment situation, you might need to be a little more proactive about making sure that you have money set aside for taxes. In all of my years of being a digital nomad, certainly prior to the pandemic, there was, because I wasn't actually a resident of any other country. I never stayed anywhere long enough to be a resident of that country. So there was no tax to be paid in that case. So I continued to file my Canadian taxes every single year, and I would claim my worldwide income on my Canadian taxes. And that basically meant I was considered a factual resident of Canada. Now, things have definitely changed. They're evolving post-pandemic. There's all these countries that are offering various digital nomad and remote work styles of visas. And this also includes, this is an ability to address the tax situation. Because if you do plan on getting one of these special visas and staying for a much longer period of time than a standard tourist visa would allow, then there may be tax. But then again, there may also be a tax treaty between Canada and that country. So it does get a little bit more complicated as you get into this lifestyle. I often say, you know, make sure that you align yourself with an accountant who's familiar with remote work and working abroad. And then that way they can advise you accordingly.
What is the insurance that you would not do this without? Is it health, augmented health insurance? Is it, what is it?
Never, ever, ever travel without insurance. If you can't afford insurance, you can't afford to travel. I'll just say that. And there are definitely many kinds of insurance, but the most important one to consider is emergency travel medical insurance. This means if something happens to you that was unexpected, these are the sort of events that can bankrupt you if you're not prepared for it. So if you have insurance that will cover medical emergencies while you are abroad, then that is the most important thing to have. In my experience, paying for preventative medicine, doctor's visits, and maybe minor prescriptions is actually quite affordable to do it by cash. So if you had to choose one specific form of insurance, it should be one that covers emergency medical scenarios.
We have just piqued the interest for a lot of our listeners, I am sure. If you were to point them towards a resource or two on pursuing a life as a digital nomad, would it be a blog? Would it be an Instagram influencer? Would it be a book? What would feed their curiosity in addition to the conversation that we have just had?
Well, I would be completely remiss not to mention my own website, which is theprofessionalhobo.com.
Oh, amazing.
Where I help people travel long-term and work remotely. And I love digging into all the specifics and the nitties and gritties, as well as sharing lots of tales of adventure and misadventure alike.
Love it. Nora, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Bruce. It's been a pleasure.
Nora Dunn has been a digital nomad since 2006, which is so inspiring in and of itself. She is also a financial expert at NerdWallet.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
We have talked a lot about wills on this show, the importance of having one, the arrival of the various online platforms that make it simple and cost-effective to do on your own. What we haven't talked about, though, is the settlement of the will. Clear Estate provides estate planning and something called settlement services all together, all in one place. Sarah Hillier is the Director of Estate Solutions for Clear Estate. She joins us now to talk about how it works. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
I've been beating this drum about get a will, get a will, get a will, get a will for years. But we haven't talked about the settlement piece. And so this is what is interesting to me in particular about your model. What do you mean by settlement services?
Essentially, what we're talking about is, you know, when you have a loved one that passes away, all of the actual practical and logistical steps that have to take place at that time and what's involved with that. Most people are familiar with some of the big things like probate, but most people aren't necessarily familiar with how much work actually occurs at that time, and that's what we help people with.
So they have done their will. The person has deceased. They have, you know, paid for your settlement services. What happens next? I mean, we talk about the online profile that you have, but I would bet that there's a human involved in moving forward on that project.
Yeah, exactly, Bruce. We actually put a lot of emphasis on our platform, but with a human to actually support and guide you through it, because estate settlements can actually be quite complex in terms of all the nuances involved, all the different institutions you have to deal with, all the different forms that have to be completed, including court filings in the vast majority of cases, as well as tax filings. All of that is what we actually support people through on a step-by-step basis, with a high emphasis on providing subject matter experts to work as a team with them to get all that work done.
What is the timing here? Does this need to be something that the individual sets up as a part of their estate plan before they pass? Or is this someone who's an executor, they had no idea how much work was involved, and they pick up the phone and retain you after the funeral has occurred?
So we actually deal with both of those circumstances. In an ideal scenario, everyone actually sits down and looks carefully at their estate plan to make sure that it's actually set up properly and that it's actually going to successfully accomplish your objectives and not leave your family kind of with a lot of stress and strain and trying to navigate the process and deal with potentially unintended outcomes. So we actually can be appointed in someone's will to act as the executor to completely alleviate that burden from their loved ones if they wish. And in which case, obviously, we do careful planning work to make sure that they are set up for success in dealing with it. However, a lay executor who is faced with the unfortunate daunting task of acting as the executor for after someone's passed away, they can come to us as well. And they can get our support with anything and everything that's involved, depending on, we have a number of different packages that are just based on the level of complexity involved, as well as the amount of support that's desired.
I have a framework for what a will is to do online. Let's call it, you know, somewhere between $100 and $500 for an online will. I have a framework for what an estate lawyer would charge. Maybe it's $1,000, maybe it's $2,000 or $3,000, depending on how complex it is. If we break out settlement services, how does that work? Is it a fee for service, like doing the will in the first place? Is it a percentage of assets? How does that work?
So if we're doing the planning, then there is a setup cost for that. And that includes the preparation of your actual wills and power of attorney documents themselves, as well as working through the entire process and creating this online profile to track all those very important things about you and your circumstances.
Right.
That's all sort of in a setup cost, as well as an annual fee. If we're actually acting as executor, there also is a percentage that's charged at the time that you pass away. However, compared to what is typically available out there in terms of that service, it's a very reasonable pricing.
Give me a number for someone who's got an estate that's, I don't know, worth $2 million or something like that. Is it 10 grand? Is it 100 grand?
It's actually 1%. Of the value of the estate, and if you're aware of what an executor, the court guidelines for executor fees in Ontario, for example, 5% is sort of the going rate that's recognized as reasonable for executor compensation, and that's whether you're a professional or an individual. So what we've done is, we're essentially wanting to be a trust company of the 21st century, right? Mm-hmm. And we're wanting to provide our services in a way that is accessible for people, that is highly efficient and tech enabled, and that they can access in an affordable manner.
It has been so hard for fintechs, for any of the insert tech companies to break into areas in particular segments within financial services because of trust, right? Like people are just used to just if I use the banks or the traditional trust companies, they're just used to all that. You're new. How do you overcome that hurdle?
I think there's a few things. So first of all, from day one, there was a high emphasis put on actually building a credible solution to this very real problem. And we continue to iterate and improve upon that every day. So while we're relatively new, what we actually have in terms of the platform itself is highly sophisticated in terms of actually solving the very real problems of estate planning and estate settlement. And then the second thing is that, of course, we've assembled a team of subject matter experts that range from, you know, the legal field, accounting field, you know, trust, estate and trust industry, and combining all of those subject matter experts together, it really is a power punch in terms of how much expertise we actually have available for our clients.
This, your origin story is also not, you know, founded in a 22-year-old's dorm room. You've got real significant and credible financial backers here in the name of OMERS and National Bank. Has that made things easier?
Yeah, I definitely think that that's something that is, you know, it's important to people. You know, certainly it's something that people sort of, it resonates with them. But I find that what is far more resonating for people is actually when they deal with us, when they talk to our people, they see the professionalism, the competency level, the knowledge, the expertise, and the fact that like we offer free consultations to just get to know your circumstances and see if and how we can help. If it's a good fit, and those consultations are no obligation. And I think that that also resonates with people that we're, you know, we're genuinely listening to what their problems are and trying to help them solve for it. And the reality is, it's very underserved, the segment of people who need help with estate settlement, unless you're, you know, in the, you know, 1% of folks who have, you know, highly complex and, you know, lots and lots of assets to deal with, you generally don't have a reasonable way to go to get help with estate settlement.
Right. And certainly any innovation is going to encourage other players in the sector to innovate because they'll look at you and think, ah, I better go on that. So at the very least, thank you for that that prompt in the marketplace. Sarah, thank you for joining us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure, Bruce.
Sarah Hillier is the Director of Estate Solutions for a company called Clear Estate. You want to look online because there's so much innovation that's been happening in the, broadly speaking, in online wills. But the particular benefit of this that I hadn't really thought about is settlement services for people who are not in the top 1%. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, has your grocery bill gone up recently? Mine has. Yours has too. You just aren't paying attention. Claire Tanzi is from Claire Tanzi's Kitchen. She will be here to share her tips to save money on food. And later, I'll speak to Barry Hillier. He is CEO of Equo. It is a, they call it a matchmaking platform that is connecting angel investors with entrepreneurs. And if you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, we have a newsletter. It comes about once a month or so. It includes stuff from this program on SiriusXM, from CBC Radio stuff that I do, CityLine, BNN Bloomberg, blah, blah, blah. Lots of insight on how to get a better handle on your money so you can live the life you want.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit. As I said, the counseling is free and judgment free. If you are the person in your family or the person in your family who is headed out to the grocery store, you have definitely noticed that prices in so many of those aisles have increased. And if you haven't noticed, you're not paying attention, because there are really significant increases in so many different areas. But our next guest says it is not impossible to keep a lid on the price of food. Claire Tansey is the creator of Claire Tansey's Kitchen. She is here to share her tips on how you can save money when grocery shopping. Hello there.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
I used to be able to get a dozen eggs for $2.79. Now it is for sure $3.79. What are you noticing when you're shopping?
It's interesting that the prices seem to be up across the board. In the past, I have noticed certain items go up. And then at the beginning of this, let's call it rough patch that we're in, I saw some really unusual items went up. Like the price of instant coffee went up by about 50%. The price of pumpkin puree. And I thought, well, now, those are discount items to begin with. So if those are going up, what else is going on?
You have a whole bunch of ideas, some of which I've never heard of or thought of. Mm. The first one I can see making a big difference, and for some people it'd be a big lifestyle change, that is eat half as much meat.
Mm-hmm. Yes, meat is always going to be one of the places that we spend the most money. So if you can, to your point, if you can change your lifestyle, or maybe you're vegetarian curious, it's possible.
Or maybe I love that phrase. I'm veg curious.
So maybe you're even vegan curious. You are trying to, you notice that the price of meat is really probably the highest line on your grocery bill. Maybe dairy, they might fight with each other. But if you can cut back on meat, and this is not like you only get half chicken breast, like, and you just have to go and cry in your bedroom. No. Instead of just having smaller portions, you actually supplement that meat protein by incorporating things like lentils and legumes. So one example I love to use is anytime you're using ground beef in something like a chili, or, you know, one of my favorites is Sloppy Joe's. Mm. Use half as much meat and supplement the rest with canned green lentils.
Which incredible. Do you think is more effective? Doing the sub in, so you serve the same dish just with less meat in it, or moving to a veg only item a couple more times a week?
Well, it really depends on your family, because if your family's not going to eat it, then that's a lose on both counts, right? So if you're going to have a hard time convincing anyone to eat a bowl full of lentils, then I would say package it up is one of my biggest tricks whenever you're trying to convince somebody to taste something. Package it up in an envelope that looks really familiar, that smells familiar, and that essentially tastes the same, but it costs about half as much.
Stop focusing on shopping the outer aisles. What do you mean by that?
I know. And haven't we always been taught this? If you want to eat healthy, you got to shop the outer aisles, right?
Uh-huh.
No. Oh my gosh. Here's the thing with shopping the outer aisles. It's smart in principle because, yeah, there's lots of great stuff in those outer aisles. Fresh produce, obviously meat, dairy products. But those are the things that if you buy them, they have the shortest shelf life. So if you buy them and you don't have a plan to use them, they are the things that are more likely to go to waste. And then you end up throwing them out, which is the worst. So yeah, the outer aisles are great, but please don't forget about all the incredible, nutritious, affordable, versatile items that you can get in the middle aisles. Canned beans, canned tomatoes, pasta, rices, peanut butter. All of those things are healthy, affordable staples that you can do lots of different things with, and they're not going to go bad in 2.5 hours.
Yeah. Eat what's in the freezer is another tip. Stock the freezer with your own convenience foods. I bet you are not going to say, Eggo waffles are on that list. What do you mean when you say no, convenience foods?
But you can make your own waffles. Waffles freeze like a dream. And so the next time you're making waffles, just make a double batch and then put them in the freezer. I always say to people, my students think that stocking the freezer, it's like, you'll appreciate this, Bruce, that this is not a savings account. It is petty cash. You want to be in and out of your freezer every single day. Okay. Like, you're not putting a club pack of chicken thighs in there for 2024. No, you're putting it in there for next week. So you should be in and out of that freezer every single day. And when you do things, I call them doing favors to your future self, that means you're just making a big batch of something and that freezes really well. And you're putting half of it or two thirds of it in the freezer. So then that becomes your convenience meal for later on when you're strapped for time.
I so love that, because sometimes I look in my freezer and I think, okay, I don't know when I don't even know who put that in there, but it's like the package of whatever is underneath my will. That's how like neglected.
It should be in your will. You should be bequeathing that to somebody. Yes.
Okay. You recommend people consider changing supermarkets, which this one is pushing me outside my comfort zone. I am very loyal. I know how to shop the store, but maybe I'm exempt from this one because I already shop at a low price supermarket.
Well, this is what I generally recommend is I generally recommend the discount supermarket. So a million years ago, I worked in the grocery business. And so I have seen firsthand the care, the quality that goes into those discounted, unbranded products. And I can tell you that it is the exact same quality and the exact same kind of flavor profile that is going into the name brand stuff. So if you are looking for little ways to save on every single item that you buy, really don't think that you can't buy the discounted and off-name stuff because you think it's made with sawdust and grubs or something. It's not. It's made of high quality stuff. And yes, you've got to put your loony in to get your shopping cart, but then you get your loony back. And honestly, I'm super frugal. I know the price of every single ingredient that I buy. And there are often differences as big as 50% when you shop in the discount grocery stores. It's and the amazing. Stuff is good quality. Like, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid.
What are the ingredients that you splurge on?
So I have in my entire life, I only have 7 ingredients that I splurge on. One of them is meat that I get from a local butcher, because I really think that you can taste the difference. And we buy a lot less meat. It costs a lot more and we enjoy every single microscopic iota of it. Same goes for fish. I also think that olive oil, extra virgin olive oil and balsamic vinegar, 2 ingredients that are really worth the money. But don't go splashing out. Like, you're not drinking the balsamic vinegar. You're not putting it in your like pulled pork slow cooker dish. Like, you're using that carefully. The extra virgin olive oil, you're only using it in your salads and to finish dishes off with. I also really love real vanilla for baking, and that is crazy expensive right now. And I love real lemons, and I love real tuna fish packed in olive oil. And that is about it.
Okay. So what about organic fruit and veg?
No, I'm not into it. I hope that doesn't sound too terrible, but no. I just don't, for me, the cost doesn't, help me. What's my, well, it's not, doesn't the benefit
doesn't pay out. The cost one. Doesn't exceed the benefit.
The ROI isn't there. I don't know.
Oh my gosh. Music to my ears.
I know I don't think that organic is healthier. And I know it's more expensive and it's often lower quality and it's often from further away. So I would much rather buy a local conventional apple than an organic apple that came in from California. Mm.
My thing is, they don't look as appealing. When I'm walking the store, I think, oh, that's kind of, maybe it's because I'm
They're
in such
buffed.
A low price grocery store that's like organic. We don't do organic here. Okay. I want to finish with one recipe or one meal idea that is in your top 5 for easy and affordable that we might not think to make. So I made your tacos. I've made your sloppy joes. I'm a big, big Claire Tansy fan. And Korean sticky beef. Love that too. Mm-hmm. What is one that you would put on our radar that would be like, we should go and do an internet search on that Claire Tansy plus this recipe name and make it tonight or tomorrow?
That's easy. Cheesy Dutch baby. It sounds fun. It tastes even better. It is made up of 4 eggs, 2/3 of a cup of milk, 2/3 of a cup of flour, 2/3 of a cup of cheese. You have got those ingredients probably in your kitchen right now. It is kitchen magic. You whip all those things together, start them on the stovetop, throw them in the oven. My son, when he was younger, used to actually watch at the oven door as this thing rose, because it rises like a beast out of the out of the Loch Ness. It's magical. It is crispy on the outside. It is custardy on the inside. It is deeply satisfying. You're eating it within 20 minutes. It is kitchen magic. And it costs you probably 32 cents a portion, something like that.
Only Claire Tansey's child would be raised to believe that the glass in the oven door is as exciting as television. He's like, Wiggles, who wants to watch the Wiggles? I am watching a Dutch baby come to life.
Honestly, once you see it, you will understand. You will also watch Dutch baby TV.
Genius. That could be a channel for you. Claire Tansey, thank you so much.
My great pleasure.
Claire Tansey. She is the creator of Claire Tansey's Kitchen. Find her online. She's got 14,872 million amazing and affordable recipes.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, a matchmaking platform that connects small businesses with investors. But first, tips to avoid straining your marriage during retirement. Amy Dupree from Life Transitions will be here. If you want to get caught up on episodes, past episodes of Moolala, go to moolala.ca. You can listen to them there. You can search by guest name, by topic. You can also go to the podcast platform, Stitcher, Spotify, Amazon Prime, all of them, and listen to them, download them to your phone. You could write a review. You could even subscribe. How cool could that be?
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Retirement is a big, big transition. It's a big transition, and it can be really hard on people financially, socially. It can be really hard on relationships, right? Amy Dupree is the founder and chief executive of Life Transitions, a Toronto-based consulting firm. She is here now to talk about tips for keeping your marriage together during this life stage, during this time of your life. Hello, Amy.
Hello, Bruce.
This is both not a financial topic and completely a financial topic because divorce is so expensive. So if you're retired, it behooves you to stay in that marriage for as long as you can, if only because you don't want the financial consequences of divorce. How common is it for couples in their retirement years to say, I am D-O-N-E?
Well, it is common. But the other thing, Bruce, that I think is more important than just how many people are breaking up is how many people are staying together, but aren't as happy as they could be. Let's talk about that too, right?
Uh-huh. What is the source of the discontent? If you were to oversimplify, I'm sure there's many, many different variables, mm-hmm. but if you were to oversimplify, what would you say it is?
I would say it is a lack of communication is a big part of this. And that covers a big thing. And what I mean is a lack of communication about how we each want to live in retirement. What's your ideal retirement? What's my ideal retirement? How much time do we want to spend together versus how much time do we want to spend apart from each other? What does that look like? So I could keep going on, but these are some of the topics that people don't think to talk about.
And it is rare that two people in a couple will retire on the very same day. I mean, like it's just very, very rare. So you've probably got someone who's a year ahead, maybe 10 years ahead. How does that play into it?
Well, or 20 years ahead, right? Because lots of people are married to people significantly older. So here's one of the ways that plays in. Let's say you're the person who retires first. And your spouse is still working, and then they kind of, without having a conversation, and either of you, they decide that since you're now home, you're going to do all of the household tasks because you're home. And you're like, wait a minute, but I'm retired. I chose to retire, not to suddenly come home and take care of everything.
So you can see again where there's this lack of communication can get in the midst of all of this.
And I
so that's one of the issues.
I can see too, the person who is not retired having perhaps an overinflated view about the decisions they get to make financially.
Yep, overinflated view of that. And also expectations that they've never shared, not just about the money, but about their lives too.
I'm
and
so
then,
not looking
then,
forward
I flip
to my,
that, Bruce?
Yes, of course, please.
The flip on that is now I'm the one home and I want to go travel and you're still working and you're not really that happy that I'm kind of planning my trips and wanting to go travel, or I feel held back because you're continuing to work and I don't get to have the kind of retirement I want. So you can see it can play out all sorts of ways.
I'm already predicting how annoyed I'm going to be if my husband sleeps in later than me when he's retired. Like,
yes,
I'm just going to come and get a glass of cold water and dump it on his head. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know what happened. Get out of bed. So in a perfect world in which Amy gets to determine the time that the sun rises and sets, what would this conversation include? And when would it occur? So couples in the super dreamy, oh my gosh, rainbows and uniforms, unicorns, perfect way of approaching this life transition. When would the conversation occur and what would it include?
Well, first of all, I see it as a set of evolving conversations. Mm. So it's not a one and done. This is one, because, you know, as we move closer into retirement and even in our first few years, you know, you learn things and you shift and you change. So you have to keep the conversation going. But as to when, I think as you're making your financial retirement plans in the last 5 to 7 years before you're going to actually go into retirement, start the conversations. And some of them are around, again, the things I've said, you know, what's your vision of a fabulous retirement? Like if mine is, we're going to travel internationally for the first 3 years and do lots of that. And yours is, this is my time to finally kick back and sleep in, and maybe we'll do a trip or two. We need to get on the same page about what that means for us, right?
What do you notice about how often couples need to recalibrate? So they have this conversation in theory, because that's what they think they want.
Right.
And then here it is in reality. You're a couple of years in, you think, I don't like this. I know we're doing exactly what we said, and this isn't working for me.
And you're totally right about this, because it's all theoretical until you get into it, right? And it's like everything else we do in our lives. Until you're actually experiencing it, you're just projecting forward. And then that's why I say it's evolving conversation, because it's like, okay, I say to people, you probably want to have these conversations every 3 to 6 months for a while, just to kind of check in and say, where are you on this now? Where am I on this now? Now that we're actually living it, what does it feel like?
Couples are not great talking about money at any time.
No,
but in retirement, one of the dynamics that's a little bit different is income is now fixed. Even if it is high, it is fixed. There's no variable nature here. How do you ensure that that conversation happens in a way that both humans are able to communicate freely about something that is so, so touchy?
Yeah. And this is sometimes where it's great, you know, if they're working with a financial professional, financial professionals can be really helpful in these conversations in getting couples talking about where things are. I work a lot with financial professionals, so I know this. And it's the idea of, if you can't do it alone, don't let that stop you from having the conversation. Do it with a third party in the room, right? Whether it is the financial professional or a life coach or a counselor, because financial conversations are too important to ignore. I know you feel that way, Bruce.
I do. It's a very core value of mine.
How do you
start the conversation? Because, I mean, we can go through here are the things to talk about. In some couples, just putting this on the table is going to be a big, big step.
One of the things is you have to kind of know your partner in this about, are they better if you give them lots of warning? Like, you know, I've been thinking about this and I think it would really be great if we could plan to have a conversation about how we both see the money in retirement and how we see how we're gonna spend it and how we're not gonna spend it. What does that look like? What's our lifestyle gonna be like? Can we plan to have that conversation? And I say that because sometimes if you're like me, I could have a conversation in the spur of the moment, but that can absolutely overwhelm some people who need that time to think about it and plan for it, then set the time to have it. And I always say a small conversation that goes well is much better than a conversation that covers too much territory and then it falls apart. So try to keep the conversation targeted and small. So maybe you're going to talk about what's it going to be like in our first year in retirement or first 6 months in retirement? When do we have to come back and look at it again together? But I think this is something that you can't ignore and you can't just say, well, you know, we're going to be okay. You have to talk about it.
What's an indicator for you that you would offer our listeners as being an indicator that would point to a situation that is acute? That is, we need to call a professional here. So if we put it in a health context, if you've got an elevated heart rate or you are feeling dizzy or you're, you know, XYZ, you know that you got to go see the doctor, that here's some symptoms that you know you need to go to see the doctor.
Yeah.
What are some symptoms in a relationship for a couple in retirement that you'd say, you need a third party here? You need to amp up the intervention because what you're doing is going to be insufficient and you're headed down a troubling path.
I would say if you are harboring resentment on a regular basis, you feel filled with resentment about whatever the situation is, you're not getting to live the life you want, you're partner or spouse isn't behaving as you would like them to do in retirement and you're kind of seething with resentment. And if you're harboring fantasies about leaving, you know, lots of couples before they leave start kind of making the, my life would be better if I were not in this relationship sort of fantasy.
Surely most people have those like every once in a while, especially when George Clooney's on the television or movie screen. Come on. But you're like talking like more than once a week recurring.
Well, I think if you're having a fantasy once a week about leaving your relationship, you probably need to go chat.
Okay. I'm not for the record. Yeah. I'm not.
Okay, Bruce, are you trying to tell me something? Do we need to talk after this?
Yeah. No,
stuff. Occasional, of course, we all have an occasional, but if that's recurring, go talk to somebody and get it out in the open and have the conversations.
Amy, thank you for your time and insight.
Thank you, Bruce. A pleasure to be your guest.
Amy Dupree is the CEO of Life Transitions, which is a Toronto-based consulting firm. And we were talking about some of the conversations that couples really, really need to have. I mean, sure, they need to have them through the entire gestation of their relationship, but in retirement in particular, the game changes when, you know, one or the other of you or both of you are no longer working the job. Stay with us. Coming up next, Barry Hillier, CEO of Equo, is here to talk about his matchmaking platform for entrepreneurs and investors. If you have comments or questions for the show, our email address is ask@moolala.ca. On social media, I'm not on Instagram, but I am on Twitter at Bruce Sellery, S-E-L-L-E-R-Y, Bruce Sellery Moolala on Facebook. Moolala is sponsored by Home Equity Bank, the provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Here's the big idea. It empowers Canadian homeowners age 55 plus to live retirement on their terms by providing them with a safe and easy way to access the equity built up in their home. And given the prices of houses these days, that equity can be considerable. The funds can be used for whatever the client wants or whatever the client needs. And that could be travel, it could be helping grandchildren, or it could be supplementing their day-to-day expenses. You can access up to 55% of your home's value with no monthly mortgage payments required. Go to chip.ca to learn how you can stay in the home you love without having to move or downsize. That's Home Equity Bank.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Sellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
If you're an entrepreneur, you know how difficult it can be to start a business, to run a business, to fund a business. And certainly in the last couple of years with the pandemic, small business owners were hit so, so hard. How can they get the support, the funding that they need in order to make a go of it? Equo is a Toronto-based company that's building a matchmaking platform that connects small businesses with capital, with investors. CEO Barry Hillier joins me now to talk about how it works. Hello.
Hi, Bruce. It's a real pleasure to be here today. Thank you.
What is the problem that you are trying to solve?
The fundamental problem is that founders, specifically small business founders, are really struggling to find the capital and the resources that they need. And in particular, they're struggling to find not just investment, but even the general capital that every single business out there needs just to get by and manage cash flow.
Where does this capital come from? Are you tapped into Elon Musk's personal bank account, or you got a red phone to Warren Buffett? Where's the funding come from?
Yeah, that would be fantastic, but it's not the traditional people that you usually hear about. In fact, where we're tapping into and who we're tapping into are, you know, for instance, if you take a look at angel investors, less than 70,000 of the 1 million accredited investors just in Canada, they're less than 70 of them are part of any formal angel group. And so you've got over 900,000 angels who are looking for manufacturing companies, real estate companies, agriculture companies, forestry companies, all of the types of companies that aren't typically what you hear about in the ecosystem. So we're pulling not only them in, but we're also starting to pull in those groups of investors who are starting to emerge, especially through the COVID days, where you have groups of women who are gathering together to pool $5,000 or $25,000 to make collective investments, or groups of immigrants doing the same things. So we're really reaching out into the alternatives in the ecosystem who are equally struggling to find those investors in deal flow. And then additionally, we're looking at capital providers who a lot of founders really aren't aware of. They're either alternative fintech, alternative banks, alternative credit, or even things like factoring companies that could really help founders manage cash flow situations, but they're not even aware that those solutions are available.
There are so many examples in the economy today of matchmaking platforms that bring buyers and sellers together. It's Kijiji, it's Tinder, it's, you know, I mean, the list is endless. What would you say is the most powerful element of the platform that you have built? Because in theory, it's like, of course, you've got all these angel investors. They want to find a home for their capital, both because they want to make money and they want to make a difference. You've got entrepreneurs, small business owners who want to find funders. But what's the wow?
I think that the wow is we're able to actually match capital providers and founders based on mutually aligned criteria at the right time. Most platforms that you see out there are looking at a single moment in time. They're not actually following, for instance, the founder throughout their entire journey. So as soon as they're finished emerging from being a startup, they get to that next phase. Who are the right capital providers at that time? At what point do they get ready to get organized for commercial banking and larger later series rounds of investing? We are really there to support the ecosystem throughout the entire journey. So the wow factor is really a community that's built around the entrepreneur first, based on the concept that if our entrepreneurs are successful, everybody else in the ecosystem is going to be far more successful than they are now.
Let's talk about an example. Tell us about the Barber Stocks.
Yeah, so Shira and Rai Barberstock are pretty amazing. They're indigenous advisors that are part of EQUO. And what's been really important for us is to build off of EQUO based on all these different life experiences and different backgrounds. So for instance, if you take a look at small businesses, there's 1.2 million in Canada, 583 million globally. Over 80% of those businesses are made up of women. They're made up of Indigenous founders, Black founders, immigrant founders, persons of the visible minority, persons with disabilities, LGBTQ+, and persons over 60. And so it was very important for us to make sure that we had representation as part of EQUO. And Shire and Ride Baberstock are very unique, because not only do they have the Indigenous experience, both of them as a couple are just completing their PhDs. Rye is completing his on indigenous trade, and Shira is completing hers on procurement. So they're very, very focused on understanding the importance of the economic and the agency of being able to take control of your life through entrepreneurialism. And in fact, indigenous entrepreneurs are 9 times more likely to start a business than non-indigenous. So Shire and Rye have gotten involved with us, not only to help ensure that we're building an ecosystem that's capable of helping indigenous entrepreneurs grow, but that they're able to help ensure that we're creating a place where non-indigenous companies can access indigenous businesses from a procurement standpoint, as well as for us to be able to get access for indigenous companies to the full marketplace. So
the big idea that you're talking about totally resonates. The smaller idea for investors is like, what's my return here? So how do you think about that return?
Yeah, it's an impact philosophy. So first and foremost, the return has to be economic, because you know, DEI is not an investment philosophy in and of itself. It's being able to find and secure incredible companies. Like if you look at Virtual Gurus, which is Bobby Raisett, she has just secured her first Series A. That company is growing. There are tons of incredible indigenous businesses that are just below the radar. So the ability to have investors who aren't indigenous recognize and see the growth potential, but then over and above that, to realize the impact that those successful businesses have within the indigenous ecosystem.
What does it take for an entrepreneur to ready themselves to put their presence onto your platform? How much work is involved? What's the key thing that they need to have ready and set to go?
Well, the starting point is creating their profile. So it's going through and it's providing information on the company, the industry, what's the revenue, what's the founder composition, basically going through and providing all the details that a bank, for instance, would be looking for. Not such a deep, deep level that you're worried about providing some info, but enough that we can then start to create the matches to capital providers as well as investors. And what we're able to do is then, based on that stated and derived data, create matches based on investors and capital providers who are looking for companies like yours. And so we're creating a more efficient deal flow on all sides so that investors and capital providers can give approvals more quickly and more often, but we're also wasting less time and allowing our founders to focus on their business.
In five years, how many deals are you doing a year and at what total dollar volume?
So we're just getting started right now with our alpha, but our
goal— I know, that's why I gave you 5 years. I didn't say tomorrow.
No, fair enough. So our goal is we want to be at around 300 to 400,000 members in 5 years. And the total deal flow that we want to have going through is going to be in the billions. And our goal is to be able to secure, because we're not every founder is going to be able to find or access or get deal flow. What we're hoping to be able to do is to elevate the companies who, first and foremost, about one out of every five companies that fails was actually profitable. We want to make sure that we're increasing that group right out of the gate, so that way we have less failures. And then what we want to do is to get more people to scale to that next level. And so our hope is that we are literally doing hundreds of thousands of deals that are going to amount to billions of dollars of transactions.
Interesting stuff. Barry, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Bruce. And if anybody is interested, they can go to gosmallcanada.com and learn more.
The platform is called EQUO, E-Q-U-O, when I was speaking to CEO Barry Hillier. Well, that is our show for today. Thank you to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and Home Equity Bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Our email address is ask@moolala.ca. ask@moolala.ca. You can send us your comments, your questions, your story ideas, your feedback, your recipes, whatever you want to send us, you send it to ask@moolala.ca. You can also subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca. Subscribe to the podcast on any of the platforms in which you may have found us in the first place. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.